Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
Well, good afternoon. We are starting into our discussion. We're going to be in the parasha, or the portion of the Torah today in our study. We're going to be going through Numbers 25, verse 10, through Numbers 30, verse 1. So primarily, we'll be cruising through Numbers 25 through 29, just catching the first part of chapter 30. While Israel remained in Shittim, the people began to play the harlot with the daughters of Moab. For they invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. So Israel joined themselves to Baal of Peor, and the Lord was angry against Israel. And the Lord said to Moshe, "Take all the leaders of the people and execute them in broad daylight before the Lord, so the fierce anger of the Lord may turn away from Israel." So Moshe said to the judges of Israel, "Each of you slay his men who have joined themselves to Baal of Peor." Then behold, one of the sons of Israel came and brought to his relatives a Midianite woman in the sight of Moshe, in the sight of all the congregation of the sons of Israel, while they were weeping at the doorway of the tent of meeting. Then Pinchas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aharon, the priest, saw it. And he arose in the midst of the congregation and took a spear in his hand. And he went after the man of Israel into the tent and pierced both of them through, the man of Israel and the woman through the body. So the plague of the sons of Israel was checked. Those who died by the plague were 24,000. Then the Lord spoke to Moshe, saying, "Pinchas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aharon the priest, has turned away my wrath from the sons of Israel, and that he was jealous with my jealousy among them, so that I did not destroy the sons of Israel in my jealousy. Therefore say, behold, I give him my covenant of peace, and it shall be for him and his descendants after him, a covenant of a perpetual priesthood, because he was jealous for his God and made atonement for the sons of Israel." Now the name of the slain man of Israel who was slain with the Midianite woman was Zimri, the son of Salu, a leader of a father's household among the people of Shimon. The name of the Midianite woman who was slain was Cozbi, a daughter of Zur, who was head of the people of a father's household in Midian. Then the Lord spoke to Moshe, saying, "Be hostile to the Midianites and strike them, for they have been hostile to you with their tricks, with which they have deceived you in the affair of Peor and in the affair of Cozbi, a daughter of the leader of Midian, their sister who was slain on the day of the plague because of Peor." Chapter 26. Then it came about after the plague that the Lord spoke to Moshe and to Eleazar and the son of Aharon the priest, saying, "Take a census of all the congregation of the sons of Israel from 20 years old and upward by their father's households, whoever is able to go to war in Israel." So Moshe and Eleazar the priest spoke with them in the plains of Moab by the Jordan at Jericho, saying, "Take a census of the people from 20 years old and upward, as the Lord has commanded Moshe." Now the sons of Israel who came out of the land of Mitzrayim were Reuben, Israel's firstborn, the sons of Reuben, of Hanoch, the family of the Hanochites, of Palu, the family of the Palutites, of Hezron, the family of the Hezronites, of Carmi, the family of the Carmites. These are the families of the Reubenites, And those who were numbered of them were 43,730. The son of Palu, Eliab. The son of Eliab, Nemuel, Datan, and Abiram. These are the Datan and Abiram who were called by the congregation, who contested against Moshe and against Aharon in the company of Korah, when they contended against the Lord. And the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up, along with Korah, when that company died, when the fire devoured 250 men, so that they became a warning. The sons of Korah, however, did not die. The sons of Shimon, according to the families of Nemuel. The family of the Nemuelites. Of Yamin, the family of the Yamanites. Of Yachin, the family of the Yachinites. Of Zerah, the family of the Zerites. Of Shaul, the family of the Shaulites. These are the families of the people of Shimon. 22,200. The sons of God, according to their families, of Zephon, the families of the Zephonites, of Hagi, the family of the Hagigites, of Shuni, the family of the Shunites, of Ozni, the family of the Oznites, of Eri, the family of the Erites, of Arod, the family of the Aroids, Arli, the family of the Arlites. These are the families of the sons of God, according to those who were numbered of them. 40,500. The sons of Yehuda were Er and Onan, but Er and Onan died in the land of Canaan. The sons of Yehuda, according to their families, were of Shelah, the family of the Shelanites, of Perez, the family of the Perizzites, of Zerah, the family of the Zerites. The sons of Perez were of Hezron, the family of the Hezronites, of Hamul, the family of the Hamulites. These were the families of Yehuda, according to those who were numbered of them, 76,500. The sons of Issachar, according to their families, of Tola, the family of the Tolites, of Puvah, the family of the Punites, of Pashub, of Yashub, the family of the Yashubites, of Shimron, the family of the Shimronites. These were the families of Issachar, according to those who were numbered of them, 64,300. The sons of Zebulun, according to their families, of Sered, the family of the Seredites, of Elon, the family of the Elonites, of Yalil, the family of the Yalilites. These are the families of the Zebulunites, according to those who were numbered of them, 60,500. The sons of Yosef, according to their families, Manasseh and Ephraim. The sons of Manasseh, of Machir, the family of the Machirites. And Machari came the father of Gilead, the family of the Gileadites. These are the sons of Gilead, of Yezer, the family of the Israelites, of Herek, the family of the Helekites, and Asriel, the family of the Asrielites, and of Shechem, the family of the Shechemites, and of Shemida, the family of the Shemidites, and of Hefer, the family of the Heferites. Now Zelophehad, the son of Hefer, had no sons, but only daughters. The names of the daughters of Zelophehad were Mahlah, Noach, Hoglah, Milcah, and Tirzah. These are the families of Manasseh, and those who were numbered of them were 52,700. These are the sons of Ephraim, according to their families, of Shethulah, the family of the Shethulites, of Becher, the family of the Becherites, of Tahan, the family of the Tahanites. These are the sons of Shetulah, of Ernan, the family of the Ernites. And these are the families of the sons of Ephraim, according to those who were numbered of them, 32,500. These are the sons of Yosef, according to their families. The sons of Benjamin, according to their families, of Bela, the family of the Belaites, of Ashbel, the family of the Ashbelites, of Ahiram, the family of the Ahiramites, of Shephufam, the family of the Shephufamites, and Hufam, the family of the Hufamites. The sons of Bilah were Ard and Naaman, of Ard, the family of the Ardites, of Naaman, the family of the Naamites. These are the sons of Benjamin according to their families, and those who were numbered of them were 45,600. These are the sons of Dan, according to their families. Of Shuham, the family of the Shuhamites. These are the families of Dan, according to their families. All the families of the Shuhamites, according to those who were numbered of them, were 64,400. The sons of Asher, according to their families. Of Imnah, the family of the Imnites. Of Ishvi, the family of the Ishvites. Of Beriah, the family of the Beriites. Of the sons of Beriah, of Heber, the family of the Heberites. Of Malchiel, the family of the Malchielites. The name of the daughter of Asher was Serah. These are the names of the sons of Asher, according to those who were numbered of them. 53,400. The sons of Naphtali, according to their families. Of Jaziel, the family of the Jazielites. Of Guni, the family of the Gunites. Of Yezer, the family of the Yezerites. Of Shilem, the family of the Shilamites. These are the families of Naphtali, according to their families, and those who were numbered of them were 45,400. These are those who were numbered of the sons of Israel, 600,730. Then the Lord spoke to Moshe, saying, among these the land shall be divided for an inheritance according to the number of names. To the larger group you shall increase their inheritance, and to the smaller group you shall diminish their inheritance. Each shall be given their inheritance according to those who were numbered of them. But the land shall be divided by lot. They shall receive their inheritance according to the names of the tribes of their fathers. According to the selection by lot, their inheritance shall be divided between the larger and the smaller groups. These are those who are numbered of the Levites according to their families. Of Gershon, the family of the Gershonites. Of Kohat, the family of the Kohatites. Of Merari, the family of the Merarites. These are the families of Levi, the family of the Libanites. The family of the Hebronites. The family of the Malites. The family of the Mushites. The family of the Korites. Kohat became the father of Amram. The name of Amram's wife was Jochebed, the daughter of Levi, who was born to Levi in Egypt, and she bore to Amram, Aharon, and Moshe, and their sister Miriam. To Aharon were born Nadab and Abihu, Eleazar and Itamar. But Nadab and Abihu died when they offered strange fire before the Lord. Those who were numbered of them were 23,000, every male from a month old and upward. For they were not numbered among the sons of Israel, since no inheritance was given to them among the sons of Israel. These are those who were numbered by Moshe and Eleazar the priest, who numbered the sons of Israel in the plains of Moab by the Arden at Jericho. But among these were not a man of those who were numbered by Moshe and Aharon the priest, who numbered the sons of Israel in the wilderness of Sinai. For the Lord had said of them, they shall surely die in the wilderness, and not a man was left of them, except Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, and Yehoshua, the son of Nun. Chapter 27. Then the daughters of Zelophehad, the son of Hepher, the son of Gilead, the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh, of the families of Manasseh, the son of Yosef, came near. And these are the names of his daughters, Mahlah, Noach, and Hoglah, and Milcah, and Tirzah. They stood before Moshe and before Eleazar the priest and before the leaders and all the congregation, the doorway of the tent of meeting, saying, our father died in the wilderness, yet he was not among the company of those who gathered themselves together against the Lord in the company of Korah. But he died in his own sin, and he had no sons. Why should the name of our father be withdrawn from among this family because he had no son? Give us a possession among our father's brothers. So Moshe brought their case before the Lord. Then the Lord spoke to Moshe, saying, the daughters of Zelophehad are right in their statements. You shall surely give them a hereditary possession among their father's brothers, and you shall transfer the inheritance of their father to them. Further, you shall speak to the sons of Israel, saying, if a man dies and has no son, then you shall transfer his inheritance to his daughter. If he has no daughter, then you shall give his inheritance to his brothers. If he has no brothers, then you shall give his inheritance to his father's brothers. If his father has no brothers, then you shall give his inheritance to his nearest relative in his own family, and he shall possess it. And it shall be a statutory ordinance to the sons of Israel, just as the Lord commanded Moshe. Then the Lord said to Moshe, go up to this mountain of Abarim and see the land which I have given to the sons of Israel. When you have seen it, you too will be gathered to your people, as Aharon your brother was. For in the wilderness of Zin, during the strife of the congregation, you rebelled against my command to treat me as holy before their eyes at the water. These are the waters of Meribah of Kadesh in the wilderness of Zin. Then Moshe spoke to the Lord, saying, may the Lord, the God of spirits of all flesh, appoint a man over the congregation who will go out and come in before them and will lead them out and bring them in, so the congregation of the Lord will not be like sheep which have no shepherd. So the Lord said to Moshe, take Joshua, the son of Nun, a man in whom is the Spirit, and lay your hand on him, and give him and have him stand before Eleazar the priest and before all the congregation, and commission him in their sight. You shall put some of your authority on him in order that all the congregation of the sons of Israel may obey him. Moreover, he shall stand before Eleazar the priest, who shall inquire for him by the judgment of the Urim before the Lord. At his command they shall go out, and at his command they shall come in, both he and the sons of Israel with him, even in all the congregation. Moshe did just as the Lord had commanded him, and he took Joshua and set him before Eleazar the priest and before all the congregation. Then he laid his hands on him and commissioned him just as the Lord had spoken through Moshe. Chapter 28. Then the Lord spoke to Moshe, saying, command the sons of Israel and say to them, you shall be careful to present my offering, my food for my offerings, by fire, of a soothing aroma to me at their appointed time. You shall say to them, this is the offering by fire which you shall offer to the Lord, two male lambs, 1 year old without defect, as a continual burnt offering every day. You shall offer the one lamb in the morning, and the other lamb you shall offer at twilight. Also, a tenth of an ephah of fine flour for a grain offering, mixed with a fourth of a hin of beaten oil. It is a continual burnt offering, which is ordained in Mount Sinai as a soothing aroma, an offering by fire to the Lord. Then the drink offering with it shall be a fourth of a hin for each lamb. In the holy place you shall pour out a drink offering of strong drink to the Lord. The other lamb you shall offer at twilight as a grain offering of the morning and its drink offering. You shall offer it an offering by fire, a soothing aroma to the Lord. Then on the Shabbats, two male lambs, 1 year old, without defect, and 2/10 of an ephah of fine flour mixed with oil as a grain offering and its drink offering. This is the burnt offering of each Shabbat in addition to the continual burnt offering and its drink offering. Then, at the beginning of each of your months, you shall present a burnt offering to the Lord, two bulls and one ram, 7 male lambs, 1 year old without defect, and 3/10 of an ephah of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering for each bull, and 2/10 of a fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering for the one ram, and 1/10 of an ephah of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering for each lamb, for a burnt offering of a soothing aroma, a drink offering to the Lord, an offering by fire to the Lord. Their drink offering shall be half a hin of wine for a bull, and 1/3 of a hin for a ram, and 1/4 of a hin for a lamb. This is the burnt offering of each month throughout the months of the year. And 1 male goat for a sin offering to the Lord. It shall be offered with its drink offering in addition to the continual burnt offering. Then, on the 14th day of the first month, shall be the Lord's Pesach. On the 15th day of this month, shall be a feast. Unleavened bread shall be eaten for 7 days. On the first day shall be a holy convocation. Yet you shall do no laborious work. You shall present an offering by fire, a burnt offering to the Lord. 2 bulls and 1 ram and 7 male lambs, 1 year old, having them without defect. For their grain offering you shall offer fine flour mixed with oil. 3 tenths of an ephah for a bull and 2 tenths for a ram. 1/10 of an ephah you shall offer for each of the 7 lambs. And 1 male goat for a sin offering to make atonement for you. You shall present these besides the burnt offering of the morning, which is for a continual burnt offering. After this manner you shall present daily, for 7 days, the food of the offering by fire, a soothing aroma to the Lord. And it shall be presented with his drink offering in addition to the continual burnt offering. On the 7th day you shall have a holy convocation. You shall do no laborious work. And on the day of the first fruits, when you present a new grain offering to the Lord in your feast of weeks, you shall have a holy convocation. You shall do no laborious work. You shall offer a burnt offering for a soothing aroma to the Lord. 2 young bulls, 1 ram, 7 male lambs, 1 year old, and their grain offering. Fine flour mixed with oil, 3 tenths of an ephah for each bull, 2 tenths for the 1 ram, and 1/10 for each of the 7 lambs. Also, 1 male goat to make atonement for you. Besides the continual burnt offering and its grain offering, you shall present them with their drink offerings. They shall be without defect. Chapter 29. Now in the 7th month, on the 1st day of the month, you shall have a holy convocation. You shall do no laborious work. It will be to you a day for blowing trumpets. You shall offer a burnt offering as a soothing aroma to the Lord, 1 bull, 1 ram, and 7 male lambs, 1 year old, without defect. Also their grain offering, fine flour mixed with oil, 3 tenths of an ephah for the bull, 2 tenths for the ram, and 1/10 for each of the 7 lambs. Offer 1 goat for a sin offering to make atonement for you. Besides a burnt offering of the new moon and grain offering, the continual burnt offering and its grain offering and their drink offerings according to their ordinance, for a soothing aroma, an offering by fire to the Lord. Then on the 10th day of this month you shall have a holy convocation, and you shall humble yourselves. You shall not do any work. You shall present a burnt offering to the Lord as a soothing aroma, 1 bull, 1 ram, 7 male lambs, 1 year old, having them without defect, and their grain offering, fine flour mixed with oil, 3 tenths of an ephah for the bull, 2 tenths for the 1 ram, 1/10 each for the ram, for the 7 lambs. 1 male goat for a sin offering, besides the sin offering of atonement, and the continual burnt offering, and its grain offering, and their drink offerings. Then on the 15th day of the month, you shall have a holy convocation. You shall do no laborious work, and you shall observe a feast to the Lord for 7 days. You shall present a burnt offering, an offering by fire, as a soothing aroma to the Lord. 13 bulls, 2 rams, 14 male lambs, 1 year old, which are without defect, and their grain offering, fine flour mixed with oil. 3 tenths of an ephah for each of the 13 bulls, 2 tenths for each of the 2 rams, and 1/10 each for the 14 lambs. And 1 male goat for a sin offering, besides the continual burnt offering, its grain offering, and its drink offering. Then on the 2nd day, 12 bulls, 2 rams, 14 male lambs, 1 year old without defect, and their grain offering and their drink offerings for the bulls and for the rams and for the lambs by their number according to the ordinance. And 1 male goat for a sin offering, beside the continual burnt offering, and its grain offering, and their drink offerings. Then the 3rd day, 11 bulls, 2 rams, 14 male lambs, 1 year old, without defect, and their grain offering, and their drink offerings, for the bulls, for the rams, and the lambs, by their number, according to the ordinance. And 1 male goat for a sin offering, beside the continual burnt offering, and its grain offering, and its drink offering. Then on the 4th day, 10 bulls, 2 rams, 14 male lambs, 1 year old, without defect, their grain offering and their drink offerings for the bulls, for the rams, and for the lambs, for their number according to the ordinance. and one male goat for a sin offering, besides the continual burnt offering, its grain offering, and its drink offering. Then on the fifth day, 9 bulls, 2 rams, 14 male lambs, 1 year old, without defect, and their grain offering and their drink offerings for the bulls, and for the rams and the male lambs, and for the lambs, by their number according to the ordinance. And 1 male goat for a sin offering, besides the continual burnt offering and its grain offering and the drink offering. Then on the sixth day, 8 bulls, 2 rams, 14 male lambs, 1 year old, without defect, and their grain offering and their drink offerings for the bulls and for the rams and for the lambs, by their number according to the ordinance. And 1 male goat for a sin offering, besides a continual burnt offering, its grain offering, and its drink offerings. Then on the seventh day, 7 bulls, 2 rams, 14 male lambs, 1 year old, without defect, and their grain offering and their drink offerings for the bulls, for the rams, and for the lambs, by their number according to the ordinance. And 1 male goat for a sin offering, besides a continual burnt offering, its grain offering, and its drink offering. On the eighth day, you shall have a solemn assembly. You shall do no laborious work, but you shall present a burnt offering, an offering by fire, as a soothing aroma to the Lord. 1 bull, 1 ram, 7 male lambs, 1 year old, without defect. Their grain offering and their drink offerings for the bull, for the ram, and for the lambs, by their number according to the ordinance. And 1 male goat for a sin offering, besides the continual burnt offering, and its grain offering, and its drink offering. You shall present these to the Lord at your appointed times, because your votive offerings and your free, besides your votive offerings and your freewill offerings, for your burnt offerings and your grain offerings, and your, for your drink offerings and for your peace offerings. Moshe spoke to the sons of Israel in accordance with all that the Lord had commanded Moshe. Then Moshe spoke to the heads of the tribes of the sons of Israel, saying, "This is what the Lord has commanded." All right, well, that was a list of lots of different offerings. And where did it go? Oh, there we go. Are there any questions as we start off first? Yes, observations over here. We have a question.
When the Israelis left Egypt, originally they were 600,000 men, not people, not counting women and children.
Yeah, 603.
603,000. Yeah. And now they're up to 3 million?
Well, this one, it talks about 601,000. So we'll be going through a kind of tabulation so you can see the difference in the that's, since they're talking about men, you know, if you factor in women, children, and other people in the family and such, that could easily go that high. So that's a lot of people. So, yes.
There's some questions like, the Shulamites, because I think there's this, I've heard of a Hebrew Shulamite prayer, and then 5 women, I don't, that kind of piqued my interest. And so I was wondering how this could, how does this connect the laws for the future? Like, I know that there's a story. To me, there's a story inside the story, and I didn't really get to go digging into Esau with it. So, I mean, if you could...
The story inside the story?
Yeah. I mean, there's like five, the 5 women. Reminds me of the 5 wise and the 5 foolish.
Mm,
and okay. So there's like a deeper level of... the 5, yeah. Normally I go in and dig it out and I can see it when it's being developed. I'm getting cross-eyed. And so I just was thinking of that. And then Twilight, you said something about Twilight. And then each of the rams and each particular animal, I mean, they're named. So I was wanting to know, you know, when those particular sacrifices were made, and how they, I mean, I think they look like pillars in history. So, I mean, whatever kind of insight you have, I...
Pillars in history. Okay. We'll take a look as we go through there. And
did his father, that the daughters that died, he said, died in his own sin. So, And I just thought about the Shulamites too. The Shulamites was the there's this Shulamite woman.
Right.
So I was wondering, if, you know.
Okay. We can take a look at that. Any other observations? Yes, Anne. Are you a missionary?
It's interesting because I think, you know, so many people think that God is paternalistic or what's the word, chauvinistic, right? You know, but when it came to the seven daughters or the daughters that didn't have any brothers, God shows that he's not chauvinistic and he gave them an inheritance. But there was also one woman, I think you even sort of emphasized it as you were reading, you know, instead of saying the sons of so-and-so and the sons of... And then it said the daughter, Sarah or so whatever.
Yes, Sarah.
So tell us more about that if you already have it in your brain as to what you want to say.
We'll go as far as we can because the trail doesn't have a whole lot that's actually in the word. Yes.
What is he is to stand before Eliezer the priest, who will obtain decisions for him by inquiring of the Urim before.
Yes, the Urim.
The Lord.
The Urim. We'll be talking a little bit about that. That factors into a number of items, including the division of the land among the tribes as well. Yes.
I noticed some strange things with the sacrifices.
Aha.
How come they were taking away the bullocks one by one?
Mm-hmm.
And on the first, I got a little confused because it seems like we were going through two feasts and I wasn't sure what was going on.
Uh-huh. Okay.
But on the first day and the last day, they like had one bullock, two lambs. But during the feast, they were subtracting bullocks, but the lambs were doubled.
Mm-hmm.
And then I noticed a weird thing, and I don't know exactly, but it was talking about no servile work should be done in this day, no servile work. But two times I noticed it just said no work. So is there a difference between work?
Yeah, as far as the what it's talking about, it's basically like, you know, don't do anything at all is the versus, you know, don't do employment for whatever your occupation is. So that's kind of the distinction. Well, yeah, the servile is, you know, your basic work that you would do to stay alive, which would to earn a living, yes. To your daily sort of tasks and stuff that you do.
So how come it says
sometimes it says, okay, well we'll take a look at the specific ones where it mentions one versus the other. So that's kind of a good observation there. But it's kind of good that we're getting a recap. It's like Leviticus 23 and getting an overview of all of the festivals in one. Again, this is kind of like Deuteronomy. This is a bit of a recap for the second generation as they're getting ready to go in. So that's like 40 years later from when the first time this was passed along. Any other observations before we get going further? Questions? Thoughts? Why so many animals? Why so many animals and kinds? Times? What do you mean by times? Oh, why so many offerings? Okay. Well, it's one of those things, if you kind of rewind the tape a little bit back to Leviticus and where we started that and where the whole thing of the offering comes from, the name for it, we just say offering, it just means that, oh, you think of, you go somewhere and you bring a gift. Well, as we were looking with the offerings talked about in Leviticus, this was more than just, you know, coming to someone's party and making sure that you bring something. This is you yourself going in symbol to the presence of God. So that's, it goes back to like the ending of Exodus and going through all of Leviticus about how you approach God's presence, which, actually kind of touches into the beginning part of this thing here in Numbers 25 with what Pinchas did with the spear. So, yes, so we have another question over here.
If you didn't have a lot of today, what would we bring besides? I
mean, Romans chapter 12 has a good answer
for
that.
Yeah, I mean, like, but...
Offer yourself so, as a living sacrifice.
I mean, like, what, do I stop eating?
The things that you do. One of the things we were talking about earlier is that the way you treat other people.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, if you read Romans 12, especially the first few verses of it, it talks about that relationship. And that, and it also plays into when you go through Isaiah as well. And when Isaiah is really railing against, especially like in chapter 58 of Isaiah and chapter 1 and 2. Where the point of where God is saying, you know, get this stuff out of my face, and the offerings, get the offerings out of my face, because people were, you know, almost treating this like a party gift. You just show up at the temple and you bring something, like you'd bring a gift to somebody's house. And yet they were just living their life, treating people terribly, oppressing orphans and widows and, you know, committing murder and robbing, stealing, doing all this terrible stuff, yet they just show up with an offering thinking, oh, yeah, that's going to just smooth everything over. Well, God is saying, yeah, you think I'm a fool? Do you think I don't see what's going on other places and other times? So that kind of brings that into a little bit of what we'll be getting at with when we look through chapters 28 and 29 with the offerings. Yes, I have another question back here.
I was just wondering, it says in 25, this is my translation, says the men started to commit sexual immorality with the Moabite women who invited them to sacrifice their gods. So the people ate sacrificial meal and bowed down before their gods. And it says, so Israel yoked themselves to the Baal of Peor. What does that mean, yoked themselves?
Yoked themselves. Why? That should start some gears turning inside your brain. And right, remember Paul talking about being unequally yoked, and the Messiah also telling a parable about the ox and the donkey and yoking those together. That's one of those things. Who, and when you think of a yoke, okay, go back to those, because today many of us yoke up a team of oxen or whatever, horses even, to go anywhere or to do works. But if you watch some old movie or Western or something like that, you get some idea of what a yoke is. A yoke is something that holds more animals than one together. Even you can actually put one on one animal. But it is something that is holding the animal to something, to do something. Usually it's to pull a carriage or a wagon or something like that. It is taking the work of the animal and then transferring it to whatever's behind it. So it's either a plow or a wagon or something or other that it's hauling it around. So when it's talking about that they joined themselves together or yoked themselves to the Baal of Peor, they were, you could say, carrying this God with them instead of the God of Israel, the creator of heaven and earth, being the one that's moving with them. They are now pulling for this. Instead of being in service to the creator God, they are in service to this Baal of Peor, this false deity that was there. So that's what it's talking about, being yoked together. So when Paul's using the illusion about being unequally yoked, being together with someone who is not on the same page with you and trying to pull in the same direction can be quite foolhardy at worst, and maybe not as productive at best. But the idea is that you're supposed to be working together, kind of pulling the same way, same strength, full effort kind of thing. So with this, these people were pulling, just basically say, hey, we are going to do what this false god wants to do and move in that direction. So, yes, got a question over here. A statement. Okay.
Peor
is a place.
P-E-O-R. Peor is a place. And Baal is a what, a demon god?
Yeah, Baal just means master. And it's basically, you can also translate it as Lord. So you could say, this is the Lord of this particular area. And it filters over from, you know, if you remember the last parashat that we were at before, with the whole thing of, you know, of Balaam there, or Balaam with his donkey, and then putting the curses, wanting to put the curses on Israel, but then the Lord pretty much turning those around into blessings. Well, this is kind of the spilling over for that. It's like, well, okay, that didn't work. The passing of the curses along didn't work. So now what do you do? So they decided to take a different route and then go with the... Well, if you can't just get them overtly with the cursing, well, then we'll get them covertly with a... the immorality angle, the seduction angle. So that's what this was employed. And as you see, that was like the secret cruise missile. That's what just flew right under their radar, and they just were taken in by it. Now, one thing to also take into consideration with this is Midian. Now, what does Midian make you think of? Oh, okay, Gideon. But kind of going down later in time. Yeah, of Zipporah's father, you know, of Moshe's wives there, the great, as my dad likes to call him, one of the first recorded management consultants in the Bible there, teaching about delegation of labor and authority. So one of the great pieces of advice, because he comes to visit his daughter there in the camp when... And says, hey, Moshe, you're taking too much upon yourself. Well, it describes him as being, you know, Yitro as being this, describes him as like a high priest of Midian. Don't have much recorded in scripture as to what that means, but you think high priest of Midian. Then as you see recorded here that this, the woman here, the Cozbi, who was involved with this incident, is described as the daughter of a chieftain, somebody who was a high muckety-muck down there in Midian. So, again, this is like 40 years later from the time of their coming out at the Exodus. But that's like, wow, there's been quite a sea change from you had a high priest of Midian and you know, Moshe during his time when he was in exile from Egypt was there hanging out with Midian. So... they had that kind of interplay going, and then here 40 years from now, it's like, wow, they've become now a secret weapon that's now working against where God is going. So I guess you could say it's a... We have a question or a comment over here. Anne?
I heard a defense about Zimri and this Cozbi. I know Cozbi.
Yes.
And that is that they were in their 20s and they thought they knew it all, and, you know, and so they just wanted to do it their way.
Do it their way. Well, like I was talking about earlier, this is kind of a good example of the where your ideas of freedom go in and where they can actually go in totality if you're not really paying attention of the direction that you're going in. Because, you know, freedom and operating with freedom is great as long as you've got boundaries to work within. Because if you don't have boundaries yourself to work in, your, quote, freedom then spills over somebody else's boundary into that, into their territory, and starts to create a huge problem. So with this, we'll kind of get into this a little bit here further, but this is a situation where this couple's freedom, again, remember, this is a spillover from this whole cruise missile that Midian has sent in to the camp of Israel to take them down. And it mentions here 24,000 of them were taken down by this attack that came in. So we'll take a look here shortly on why this is so significant. We have another comment or a question over here.
I just think it's like on point exactly who the how God destroyed the plague, because it was exactly those people that were causing the plague and causing the problems, that God had to make it on point to the person that was destroyed.
Yeah, it's you could say maybe about causing it, but they were sure the prime example of it because of how flagrant they were. We'll get into a little bit of the wording of how flagrant this was at the time period. Yes, Anne, you have a...
The point is, the 24,000, were they the ones that God told the elders to slay the leaders? And they didn't do it, either they didn't do it fast enough, or their hearts weren't in doing it, and then they just didn't do it right because they're... attitude or whatever, and then Phinehas did what he did, and yet God accepted Phinehas's doing of one deed, you know, against that one couple that was just blatantly against everything that God had already told them not to do. So, but the 24,000, were they the leaders that God put down with that plague, or were they just indiscriminate people?
Well, it mentions that these were the ones involved with that. How far down the chain of command, so to speak, it went, don't know. But when we take a look at the census numbers, you can start seeing this was perhaps from one particular tribe, perhaps. And it might explain why that particular tribe's numbers in the census were down so much from 40 years earlier. So perhaps that might explain some of it. So, one of the things, let's take a look off first, is this guy, Pinchas. Pinchas, or where does he get the Phinehas from, is because in Greek they don't have the sound, so they came to something that was somewhat close. So, it's kind of like an aspirated E. So, it's kind of like, you know, when you go for those nice tasty lamb sandwiches, they looks like gyro, but it's actually gyro. Because when you actually look at it, or some people call it a hero, but it's an H with an aspirated thing on it, so it comes out like gyro. So it's like you choke your H. And so in Greek, they've had this idea of choking a sound, often on an H or an E. So that's about as close as you can get to a the het in Hebrew. So that's where you have Pinchas becomes Phinehas. So there's kind of like two main derivations that people come up with this guy's name. You could say the one of them is that it is perhaps made with two different words, one of which is the P part there, and P is both in Hebrew it's for a mouth, or to something come out of a mouth. But also in, you notice that in, the other one is, the latter part is nachas. So pi nachas, some people think that might go. And nachas, some folks think that perhaps nachas is a, you could say, a variation on the word nachash, and we've looked at nachash a lot, which is serpent. So to actually means to hiss. So I guess if you put this together, it's either the mouth or the speech of the serpent, or the mouth that hisses. One derivation of it. The other one is that there is a kind of a similar term for it means in from Egyptian, which is the man who is dark, the dark man, dark colored man. So I think maybe it might be in reference to him being dark colored or whatever. But those are kind of two variations if you look through lexicons that refers to. Kind of interesting if it's the former definition of the mouth of the serpent, or the speech of the serpent, because as we were looking at one of our back a couple ways on the bronze serpent that was on the pole. It was a very interesting thing where you had this plague of the poisonous serpents, and then you had the, quote, cure, unquote, or the basically the object that was people had to take a look at to show their faith in what God was going to do to cure these snake bites was a serpent on a pole. So the serpent was the plague and sort of the cure in that. So mouth of a serpent, perhaps, being something. Now, remember something also is that with, and it comes from Genesis chapter 3 with the idea of the serpent, because another way to, with nachash means to hiss, and it's also used in, throughout the Bible to mean to be crafty, to be sly.
Seduced?
Or, you know, it basically means to be prudent, meaning that you can either either pass something, you say things that are prudent, or you say things that are a little conniving. It's used in both ways. So we can either be prudent or conniving, depending on how it's used. So this could be the man who speaks with cunning, or who speaks with that. And that could be a bit of a, you know, a lot of times you'll see people's names will be related to the things they do. So in a sense, you could look at this whole incident with the spear and these two folk as being part of the cunning involved. And also we'll play into the next kind of word we'll take a look at. Yes, you had a question?
Hey, Jeff. Just wondering, what is early day Moab?
The what was it?
Early day Moab.
Early day Moab?
Yeah. Today, what is Moab?
Oh, Moab was, well, you think of the area, today would be probably a part of Jordan and spilling over into Saudi Arabia. It'd be that area. It's kind of down, it's southern, kind of like when you think of the Dead Sea and you think of southeast of the Dead Sea, kind of south and southeast of the Dead Sea in that area. Because if you go down further in modern-day Saudi Arabia on the west coast, following the Gulf of Aqaba, there's Midian. Ancient Midian was probably just a little bit north on the coast there from modern-day Yemen or Yemen. So that's kind of the idea of where this was happening. Kind of that in modern day Eilat in Israel, the kind of where the tip of Israel comes down and meets the Gulf of Aqaba and modern day Jordan and such. So the idea of that being where this stuff was happening. Because remember, they had gone up and were on the east bank of the Jordan and such, and they were conquering those nations, and then they were coming back down. Because Jericho is a bit south of that area, so that's the geographical context of where this is happening. Now, the next thing, which is what we get jealousy, when it talks about jealous and jealousy and such, comes from the Hebrew word of kana, and kana it. Well, it can be jealousy as we think of jealousy, or it could be zeal. It just means that someone is just hugely pumped up and they're going to go for their cause. So it, as you see kana used, it is used in both cases of both being jealous and also zeal. Because, you know, just like as we've talked about in some previous times about how some of what Paul is talking about with the faith versus following through and what you do, it is a knife edge between falling over into what you would call, some people call legalism, to where that drives you to the other side of, you know, lawlessness. And that kind of going one way or the other can be a very fine line you go. And to the point of also, if you follow what God is saying, it can quickly go into apathy towards God if you really don't watch your heart attitude and what you're doing. It becomes a rote thing you do. You do it because your parents did it and your grandparents did it and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But you're doing it because they did it and it's not really coming out of your heart. So from the outside, it looks like, hey, everything is fine. But on the inside, there can be a huge turmoil going on within you. And, you know, you're there physically, but, you know, your brain is somewhere else. Your heart is elsewhere. So the line between zeal, jealousy, and you could say what we would say dangerous going into terrorism, it can be a fine line. And today, use a big 50-cent word, there's a lot of equivocation over the idea of zeal and passion, you might say, towards a cause. Because someone will say, well, one person's fervent believer is another person's terrorist, and it's just depending on which hat you want to put on them at any given time period. But that comes down to a thing that's happening inside of your heart. Because, for example, one of the 12 that Yeshua called is, you might notice in some modern versions, he's called Simon the Zealot, or his name Shimon. And you might, if you have a King James version, you might say, and it's like Simon the Canaanite. And you're like, Simon the Canaanite? What on earth is that? Was he a Gentile, one of the first Gentiles that came through? Well, the thing comes through in the transliteration over from, he's the Canaanite, he's the zealous one. So that's why some modern translations have zealot, because Luke actually uses a different, instead of just transliterating it from Hebrew into Greek, Luke actually uses a different word which actually means a zealous person. And so in the first century, remember this from some history lessons, the zealots were a type of, you could say, hyper-nationalists. They were looking for the cleansing of Israel. Now, with that, you could say, cleansing of Israel, good idea. Because you roll the tape back, because time of Messiah is, you know, in the AD 30 time frame. Now you roll the tape back into BC 150, 160, back to the Maccabean era, and they needed some serious zeal back then because it was a time of Hellenization, and a lot of the people were just, you know, giving up the following what God was saying and going after the rising Greek culture of the time period, to the point where down with Antiochus IV, he outlawed the worship of God, and there were people that were willing to go along with it. They were okay with it because they had already stepped so many steps further and they were already heading out the door, and they just out the door is a pretty short distance anyway. So there were some in there who had zeal at that period and said, we don't care what the odds look like physically. We are going to stand up with God did, and God gave them favor and took them through to the victory of reestablishing the temple and cleansing it, putting it back into commission. But sadly, that zeal got lost. If you read on in the Maccabees, you'll see that the connection of people to God started going downhill pretty fast, and then led to civil war to the point where, you know, right, you know, down to like the end part of the BC period, they had one side actually called in Julius Caesar from Rome to deal with the matter, to get the control of the situation. So if you're wondering how it is when you start reading the gospel that the Romans are there, that's how it happened, is that you started from one zealous period to basically fighting each other and then bringing one side in. So then into the first century AD, you started to get the zealot movement, and that was going over several decades up to that time period where they were, if you read Josephus' works, he talks a lot about this, that they would stage these, we would call them terrorist attacks, really, against the Roman legions and Roman signs of authority, for example, putting up emblems of the Roman Empire in the temple, or marching toward the temple with the emblems, such like that. So that kind of zealous approach, you could say, hey, these are things that are encroaching into God's presence. But what is it that was actually happening inside the heart? So when you see what Yeshua starts interacting with some of these people, you know, Kepha or Peter started to, you could say, express things were going in that realm about, you know, wanting to strike out against people. So the time for that wasn't then. And that's what Yeshua said, hey, look, you know, don't strike out at this particular time period. You know, those who live by the sword are going to die by the sword. Now, that sort of thing is, if the sword is what drives you, if the use of force is what drives you, what will stop you? That is kind of one of the key lessons that goes through on this, is your zeal, how far does it go and where does it stop? One of the things you might say today is that in some parts of the world we have too much zeal and it's leading to lots of people getting killed and being oppressed under various empires. But, you know, what is it that your zeal is leading you to? So when you had, and you read in Acts where Paul was talking about the number of folks that were coming that were zealous for the law. What is the zeal there? Are you actually zealous for what God says and going forward with what God says? Or are you zealous for bringing in the kingdom? Which is one of the things that is brought quite clear to the 12, or I guess the 11 at that point in Acts chapter 1. It's like, is now the time for the kingdom of Israel to be established here on earth? It's like, no, not the way you're wanting to do it. No, it's not coming that way at this point. It's coming probably in the best way possible, and that's a change from the inside out. That change from the inside out has to precede any sort of change from the outside in. Because, well, that's one of the things that you see quite often with these things, and as we get into Numbers 25 further, you'll see a little bit why. So, this priest here, Pinchas, talks about his zeal. His zeal for what? And the reason why I started at the beginning of the chapter instead of verse 10 is because this really spills over from verse 10 into the passage. And let's see here. So like in verse chapter 25 in Numbers, verse 6, says, "Behold, one of the sons of Israel came and brought to his relatives a Midianite woman in the sight of Moshe and in sight of all the congregation of the sons of Israel while they were weeping at the doorway of the tent of meeting." So, this, why were they weeping at the doorway of the tent of meeting? Well, because you read the beginning part of this chapter was that this, remember the Midianite cruise missile came in of immorality and had lured huge numbers of people away and started to have them to the point where it's described as being yoked together with this other deity. Not the deity, not the creator of heaven and earth, not the one who took them out of Israel, but someone who's taken them off into a different direction. So then it talks about this plague coming against those. And Moshe and these elders were weeping there at the top of the tent of meeting. So they were weeping at the tent of meeting for the end of this plague. And in the midst of this, one of the sons of Israel brought in this woman in the sight of all of them. So it's One of the ways that this is described here, it's like almost coming in front of them. So you get this picture, tabernacle, they're at the front, and so they're at the front of the tabernacle. And this couple is now coming like either through them, they're coming through in clear sight of all these folks, and then they head into a tent. Okay. And so talk about blatant. When we were in one of our earlier descriptions, we were talking about this guy who was collecting firewood, and description there of large logs on Shabbat. And you're like, well, what would be the big deal about that? But the way that it's described there is doing so with a high hand. It's basically like, I don't care what it is that you said. I don't care what it is that's the creator of heaven and earth, the one who brought us this far, says, I'm going to do what I want anyway. I'm going to go in completely the opposite direction and in a very public manner. So one of the things that's been really in a big highlight today is how do you approach public law and order? And one of the things that's talked about in a lot of circles is broken windows policing. The idea is that if you bring enforcement upon the little things, then you can start getting in front of the things before they get to be really serious crimes. So in some cities that have gone forward with that have seen dramatic reductions in really violent, terrible stuff because they tried to intervene with folks at the very little stuff. So we see a little bit of that in some of these proclamations here, because these are things that are starting you down the path, in a very public way in front of everybody, down the path in a completely different direction. Now, if you were to say, well, okay, somebody's beliefs over here, somebody's beliefs over there, who really cares? One belief versus another belief, that kind of thing. But if you are looking at this from the aspect of this is the creator of heaven and earth looking to come and help steer mankind away from the cliff, and starting with this group of people that he's called out to be this, what he calls priesthood, basically ambassadors to the world, then it takes on a completely different perspective. It's no longer pettiness. This is like someone who keeps taking a life preserver and throwing it, and it's landing here and right on the other side and right on the other side and right in front, and the person just won't grab it because they don't see that they're sinking, and they keep throwing it. That's really what you see, the whole picture of Israel, all the way from the time of Abraham, all the way down through Revelation. It's God just keeps throwing out the life preserver all the time. But, you know, it's like one of those times, at the end of it, what do you have to do at some point? Hopefully, you know, using your little description, it could be the person reaches out and grabs the life preserver and then gets hauled back into the boat before they sink. But it's one of those things that you see also, what if someone doesn't want to grab it? Well, there's the options of, okay, you go over and you forcibly grab them, you pull them back up onto the boat. Well, what if... Yeah, this is really stretching it quite beyond the breaking point of the metaphor, but what if the person doesn't want to be in the boat? What if they don't want to be in the boat? And in a sense, that's really what you get with a lot of these. You look through Israel's history, and it looks like a giant roller coaster. It goes up, and it goes down. It goes up, and goes down. It goes up, and goes down. So those points of time, we have a comment down here. So in those points in time, where it's on the downward slope, what then do you do if the people don't want to go along with that?
Pray.
Pray.
Because unless they truly see with their heart what they're doing,
they're going to keep going in the direction they're going. They're going to drown.
Yeah. Because one of those things that we see here with this, the idolatry. And it's an interesting picture that we get here of this mixture of idolatry, and it calls it harlotry, which is, you know, a form of adultery. And you'll see those terms of harlotry, adultery, immorality used to describe how people go away from God. And idolatry is mixed in there as well. So what then is the connection here between idolatry and this immorality of going away from God? What is the connection between those? Yeah, what is the connection between idolatry and this immorality? Okay, cheating.
It's cheating. It's like you're cheating on God. In such a marriage, you're running off to another God. That's like for the God.
Yeah, so you are. Yeah, so you have a spouse and you say, okay, I'm committed, and then you're running off in some other direction. Because, you know, one of the things that it's quite interesting to note is what the emotional level of the description is in this. When God is saying to the people that he's gone through all kinds of lengths to bring him this far, that this is harlotry and adultery, moving away, that's quite an unbelievable amount of hurt. Because, you know, you're thinking between a couple, for the one person who's still there, wow, an amazing amount of hurt for the person who's now run off. And, you know, you see that kind of pain with God throughout Israel's history, of this yo-yo back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. But, you know, praise God that he still sticks with us. And we think of our own life in the roller coasters that we go through in our life, that God still sticks with us.
Yeah.
And still is willing to take us back. That's unbelievable.
Yeah, because even in marriage, if one person commits adultery, aren't you supposed to kind of try to stick it out, even though God, because God, that's God's best. He wants you to try to work it out anyway.
Yeah, it's one of those things that God gives you the out, but do you want to take it? Should you take it? And that's one of those things. God says, okay, because of the hardness in people's hearts, that the option of walking away is there for the aggrieved party in that case, the person that had been, you know, betrayed. But do you want to take it? And wow, the power of God to be able to not take that route, not become a welcome mat that you just get walked over your entire life, but to say, in spite of that, I forgive you. Wow, that is unbelievable. You know, when you think about, if you have any sort of either friends or family members where that's happened to them, the ability to do that, it takes a big move of God to be able to move that far. But, you know, when you think about that, how big that move is, then God is willing to take that move with us, sometimes on an hourly basis. We just, as Paul calls it, being dragged away and enticed by these things that come along. So for in this case of Israel, this is being hauled away and enticed by, you know, you think of this as it's described, these women from Midian came into the area. It's like, it's not like the men went off into Midian. It's like these women came in on this. So that ability to really stay with God put to the huge test. Yes?
One of the things I noticed is that this worship that was going on, I saw a small comment that it was on the mountains of Moab. So if we know where the Moabites stem from, we see the root there, the seed. So that right there is a huge indicator of, you know, if that is the root of your existence, it just continues to be just living a life of defilement, pretty much.
Yeah, it's, it, you know, when you trace back the history of Moab, you know, Moab means from father, basically, from daddy, yeah, which goes back to the time of Lot and his right daughters who...
Right, you know, so if you compare the, you know, if you're living according to God and his ways, you know, from his root, and versus this other source or seed, per se, that you can see that if you don't, if that's your origin, in a sense, that it just continues to deteriorate from there. And we have the, you know, the Israelites being influenced by that. And I just see the, you know, that until you are, you know about God and his ways, that deterioration of the generations just continues to get worse and worse. And then we see that in today with all of the, you know, homosexuality and that sort of thing running rampant these days, and just continues to get worse because the people rejected God and his ways. And,
yeah, or it just, whatever it is.
Right, right. But speaking of this in particular, because of what Baal Peor means, that's why I bring that up. But yeah, I mean, anytime we stray from him. But I also wanted to say about what you just said about, you know, couples who can forgive one another and that sort of thing. And over the last several years, I've come to learn more and more about the true patience and forgiveness of our Heavenly Father and how greatly important it is to forgive those who transgress against us, because, you know, we can throw psychology in there and say, well, you know, because I had a bad childhood and this and that and this and that. And I mean, there's some, you know, sometimes we have trouble getting over things, but I just have seen, at least, you know, in my own life, that it's so important just to forgive. And not because, like you said, to be a doormat, but because it's who he is. And he continually forgives us on a daily basis for our transgressions. And then we somehow find the right in our own flesh to say, well, because of this thing, you know, I can't continue on in a relationship with you, whether it's marriage or friendship or whatever. And I mean, I understand we're human, and I'm not saying this as a blanket statement, but just that it's just really seeing the brevity of forgiveness. You know, what an important thing it is that we really walk in it. I don't know how else to say it, you know, in words, but I just see that people need mercy and they need forgiveness, because we are generally such a broken people, and we all lack, and we all have weaknesses, and as really difficult as it is for me sometimes, and even painful to my flesh to want to forgive certain things, and it will sometimes take me a while. And I believe that there's like different levels of forgiveness. You know, you can say, well, I choose to forgive that person, but you have to continually like say it over and over again until it becomes, it sits here in your heart and you truly walk in that. Mm-hmm. But that we all need that. We need that mercy. We need that grace. And because we're all given it by him, you know, every day.
Yes.
And forgiveness is not optional. It's not. And I have had a horrible time trying to forgive somebody that's hurt me numerous times. And I could not forgive them. And I kept praying and praying, God, I can't keep hating this person. I help me. And it took me like 2 months. And finally, the Holy Spirit told me to do something, and I did it. And when I saw what was going on with the person, I couldn't hate him anymore. I said, thank you so much, finally. So I was finally able to let that stuff go and forgive that person. Whether I don't deal with the person, but I got that out of me. And the moment I forgave them, I just got slammed with so much work from God. It was like I think he had to restrain things from me for a while to let me know that I can't keep going in unforgiveness. But I actually got to forgive somebody that the person could care less. But for me, I had to do that. And what you said was so right on. But it is important. And I tell my girls, forgiveness is not optional. God says if we don't forgive others, he can't forgive us. He won't forgive us. It's not optional. We have to practice forgiveness, even though it's really hard.
Yeah, and in truly a situation that is truly beyond your control, you know, that power then lies with you. Recently when I felt quite a lot of resentment about being passed over for something, and you know, just hold that together, just eats at you and just makes you seethe until you realize, no, just got to let that go. Just move on to something else. Because otherwise, they call them painful memories or whatever, every time you remember it, you feel pain. You feel pain. But unless you just let that stuff go, it just keeps eating you and eating you and eating you as time goes on. Gives the enemy a doorway. And that is really what is beyond this. You might say that the approach that Phineas took was ridiculously vigilanteist, but it is one thing that stopped this going forward. It was incredibly drastic, and you know, as we are taught by Messiah, and God tells us that, you know, you don't take these kinds of things into your own handling. So the covenant of peace that he brought, wow, at what a price. Wow, what a price that has to be paid. It's one of the sad things that sometimes when I talk to people, I pass the analogy over, is that sometimes peaceful people have to use violence to subdue the violent. And it's a sad thing, but to really bring peace, meaning contentment, well-being for a lot of people, sometimes you just have to, you know, take strong action here on this. But when you see a lot of what the Torah commands about vigilantism, you see that, wow, that's a big no-no. So, you know, that's where I was talking about before, about the jealousy, zeal, passion. That's a fine razor's edge between going in the direction where God wants you to go and veering off the cliff into, yeah, the righteous indignation about being angry but not sin. Well, I tell you, you know, that the being angry but not sinning is, you know, it's kind of like having a giant 600 horsepower, you know, engine in your car and being in a stoplight on glare ice. Okay, how are you going to hit that accelerator to not just sit there and, you know, it is a lot of power there, but wow, you have to be extremely careful with it, because wow, it gets out of your control super fast. So when you got these things that well up in you, this anger that you want to lash out, or you think you're in the right to do this or that, wow, watch out. And you just really have to just pray for God's Spirit to really inform you what is really going on. And look at who this was who did this. This is somebody who's working anointed to go into the presence of God. Exactly. How many people did that? That guy. So that's one of those things you have to keep in mind of what sort of level of otherness. We talk about holiness of God, that's otherness. Working in a completely different realm than we are, yet stepping in to show us the direction where to go. So with this, tread extremely lightly in your feeling that you need to step in and do something. Because the scripture has an incredible paradox. And when you look at in the, especially related to like, honor your father and your mother, go well with you, and then talks about things going down to the third and fourth generation. Okay, so you got that. So it's like, wow, it sounds like, wow, you're going to have judgment going down to the third and fourth generation. Then in Ezekiel, you've got, it says, and the soul who sins dies. Not the father for what the son did, or the son for what the father did. So you're like, wow, that seems like a paradox. But it goes back to what we were talking about earlier with the legacy that comes down, whether it's from Moab, that is your history of Moab. Do you continue in that? That's what was basically served to you on your plate. Do you just gobble it all up or say, don't listen to this, kids. There are certain things on your plate that maybe you should not eat. But the metaphor there is that you have to be extremely careful on what it is that is served to you. And you think that, oh, life has dealt me this, and boy, I'm just going to seethe and lash out against everybody because, wow, it's been handed to me. Stuff happens in life. You get into a bad circumstance, you know. You're not born in the United States. You're born in the middle of a war zone. Okay. Wow, that was bad. Now, what do you do about that? Move? Okay. You know, born into horrible economic situations. What do you do about that? There's lots of things that can happen in life to you, and either whether they start out good or start out bad. And you have the power to decide how it is you're going to respond to any given situation. It may be like, you know, some of our brothers and sisters end up in prison and they die in prison. But what happens while they're in prison? Do you rot and you seethe? Or do those around you see who it is who you actually serve and see that, yeah, they've got you in a cell, but they don't have you. They've got your body in a cell, but not you. And that's really what our life can be like, and no matter what situation we're in. So, yeah, you had a comment?
I'm having the same circumstances is that I forgive, but the person, well, now it's added, but that's come to two now. Now, well, almost three. Well, yeah, it was four minus one. But when someone doesn't forgive and you do forgive, you know, and they tell people that they're this, they're that, then you forgive. It's very difficult to function in a realm. You do forgive, but they don't forgive. So your ability to function can be, you know, emotionally, it can make you sick, and you don't, and you know, it's a sense of powerlessness because the angry person or the unforgiving person is taking people with them, you know what I mean? And they believe it because we become a society that doesn't take accountability for their behavior. As you did this to me, and you know, and they might have said that for 40 years that you've done this and they never let you free of it. So for me, I'm wondering how, okay, I'm in forgiveness, but how does that, how is one, and especially if you've had this leg for years, that's the question I ask myself. How do you function like that? You know, when you're in a relationship with somebody that doesn't forgive, you know, there's a sense of guilt, like you're not allowed to leave because that's close.
Yeah, one of the things that the Apostle Paul recommends is, you know, confess your sins one to each other, and you're like, people get maybe weirded out about, you know, was this some like mutual confessionalism or something like that? But what is it that's involved with that? It is confess and forgive. Confess first and also forgive, meaning it's confession going out, forgiveness coming back. And that's hugely important, because if we got some sort of rift between there, it's like oftentimes, maybe not always, but oftentimes there's a two-way street going in there. And I know this in the things that I get irritated about, is there's a lot of stuff that's come out of me, even for some of the slights that have come back at me. So one of those things that you can always go forward with is confess what it is that you've done and forgive the things that they've done. And if nothing happens on the other end, well, okay. But it's like, okay, I've done something, you've done something, but I'm letting that go, what you've done against me. And just leave that in God's hands with that. Yeah. Yeah, the trail of the bodies may continue. It does. Right, but remember, though, that there are many people throughout history who have been in some sort of oppression that was completely not their fault. There are lots of people that are in prison right now around the world, nothing that they had anything to do with. It was completely trumped up. So what is that you do about it? You've got your choice to decide how you're going to respond. So any last thoughts before we kind of just move on to the next section here? Yes?
I was just going to respond to her, because I know sometimes, like in relationships, sometimes we're afraid of having our character defamed by other people. And, you know, if one person is walking in unforgiveness and speaking these things after there's been an attempt of reconciliation, you know, we as those people stuck in the middle of it are not to take one person's word. And in any way, it's not really our business per se. But if we have a question, we're supposed to go to that person, right? Matthew 18, the correct chapter. And if they're not walking in that, then that's on themselves.
Right.
And all we can do is continue to walk in integrity with our Father and know that we've done everything on our side to make reconciliation. And if that person still continues, you know, you just keep walking on and go where the Father wants you to go. You just walk with Him. Because that's really the only one that you need to be accountable to is Him. So if you know you're walking in blamelessly, then you have nothing to worry about.
Yeah, out of concern for the other person.
Right.
Because, you know, we can just go through life and just write off everybody who slighted us.
Right.
But the wanting to go out and reconcile, that's a huge lot of concern for the other people,
mm-hmm.
which is really at the heart of what, you know, the do unto others as you would want them to do unto you. I mean, and that goes really back to loving God with all your heart, your soul, your mind, your strength. Because would we want God to do what we've done to Him? We just basically, just walk away and get forgetful and absent-minded and downright, you know,
right.
offensive. Would we want that to God to treat us that way?
Well, and also, you know, if you can continue to walk humbly and blameless, then, you know, it could possibly open up the door for that reconciliation later on, versus if you were to lash back and, you know,
yeah, that's why I was talking about the heaping of coals upon the person's head.
Right.
Because that sort of, you know, approach to reconciliation is like, okay, now it's in the other person's court. What are you going to do about the situation? Do you want to fix it? Do you want to mend it or not? So let's go into the next section. One of the things we have up here is kind of a synopsis of the census, which shows The census as it was in Numbers 1 and catching Levi in chapter 2 of Numbers. And here it is in Numbers 26. So some of the things that to note in here is you'll notice that some of those tribes had significant reductions. Some of them had significant increases. You got, you know, Reuben went down. Shimon went way down. You know, Gad went down a little bit. Oh, Yehuda went up. And then Issachar went up, and Zebulun went up, and Ephraim went down, and Manasseh, wow, they went way up there. Benjamin went up, and a little bit up for Dan. Asher went up quite a bit. Oh, and Naphtali went down. So at the end, you'll see here that the total is about a drop of just under 2,000. And then you'll see with Levi, they went up total about 700. And one of the things that they note in the census are these are the folk that weren't, that did not come out of Egypt, except for, you know, just a few that are mentioned there of the first generation. So one of the things to note here is, especially talking about with Shimon about that big drop there, some speculate that the 24,000 that were talked about here in this plague may have come from because this one guy, what's his name? Oh, yes, Zimri. Because he was from the Shimonites, or from Shimon. So thinking perhaps that might account for that. Maybe he was kind of the ringleader for those, but wow, you think about from one generation to the next to have that kind of a significant drop, quite a testament of what can happen with when leaders, you know, lead you in one direction or the other. Because if you have, because the tribes here, as they're mentioned, those were the names that came through from the sons of Yaakov, but these people weren't around at this point. These were, you know, grandchildren, great-grandchildren by this point in time. One of the things that's mentioned here, it mentions a couple of things. One from Asher is the what's her name? Sarah? Yes, they're in.
Very beginning, Moshe had a lot of leaders hung.
Right. And then there was the, like in the thing with the Kohat, it mentions there's 250 here and some there. So there have been a few of these judgments along the way that had happened that had reduced the numbers quite considerably. But it's one of those testimonies of where are your leaders taking you? In which direction are they taking you? Are they taking you toward a prosperous path, or are they taking you in a direction where you're kind of heading off the cliff?
Yeah.
But one of the things that's mentioned here, that was brought up in Numbers 26, verse 46, about this daughter of Asher named Sarah. Now, quite note that you're noting the daughter of Sarah. It's like, okay, this is Jacob's generation here. That's quite a long time ago. By this point in time, maybe 250 years, and you're talking about the daughter of, and she was numbered in here in the census. So some legends that grew up that she was like, you know, nearly immortal or had an incredibly long life. Because when you look at lifespans, yeah, they were a bit long, but not 250 years. So Just a little bit of an interesting note here as to she was numbered in this, but it's like, wow, either she was unbelievably old or she's just noted in here for a very specific reason as to.
What verse is that?
That's Numbers 26, verse 46. And as a note near the another part in talking about the daughters of Zelophehad talks more about this in Numbers chapter 27, where these daughters that he had, these four daughters, and brought up the interesting mention that these are his only descendants. So thus you've got the law that comes down, well, okay, if man has no sons, then goes to the daughters. And thus his name continues. Because one of the things that's mentioning here, and we kind of continue this on in Western cultures a bit, is that the name, literally our names pass along through the male side. You know, the male gets married, and usually the woman takes a name. Not so much in Eastern cultures. You know, that was always an amazing thing over in Korea, because you never know who was actually married to whom, because they would just keep their name from their father. When the woman got married, she would keep the name of her father. So you'd have, you know, Mr. Bach and Mrs. Sheen, and then her son is Bach. So you're like, okay. But Sheen has now a son named Bach. So you're like, wow, that's always got a little bit confusing. But that just shows a little bit of a different mindset, that this mindset that's come down to our culture has come a lot through what you have mentioned here in Scripture of the man coming through. But one of those cases is like, okay, you know, the man being, you know, physically stronger than the woman, yet in a lot of ways the complementary side is that the woman is a lot better than the man in certain other areas. One of those other areas that woman tends to be a lot stronger in is spiritual connectedness and the ability to communicate. That's just the way it is. No matter what culture you go in, tends to be the way it is. When you go into congregations, most of them in there, no matter what faith you talk about, they're mostly women in there, except for some. And then when you look in there, all you see are men because the women are kept outside. One of the key things that has come down through Jewish culture a lot is that the Torah was given and instructed for men because men need it. And women, it just really comes sort of naturally to women, this connection of relationship. But men really need to actually focus and say, hey, where you come from is hugely important to where you're going. So this legacy that comes down to you, this name, it's not just, you know, Jones or whatever. It is reputation. Name is about reputation. What are you known for? So today we don't have the great names like you had, like even in ancient England, you know, like with Edward the Unready. Ooh, I wouldn't want that name. Not a great king, but you know, one's named Ironsides and, you know, Longshanks. Leaders like that, what their name took on the reputation that they had and what they were known for. So for us today, when we pass on our name to our next generation, what is it that we are known for? And does that name get picked up by the next generation? Because if you go to generations down and all that they have left is Jones or Smith or whatever, and who you are and what you stood for, not there at all anymore, in a sense, your name has sort of died. Because, I mean, it's sad. I have a name here, and I trace it back genealogically to a guy who came over from Holland in like mid-1600s. And I have no idea what they were like. And you look through genealogical record, one side were Tories, and the other side, they were colonialists, the rebels. So it's like, what were they all about? No idea. That legacy of what these people stood for, the Hatfields and McCoys, what is it that you stand for? I mean, sadly, you could say what they stood for went on for generations, because the battle just keep going from one generation to the next. But for us, the legacy that we pass on, what legacy is that? And the interesting thing is that for Moshe and Aharon and them, their legacy was really about Caleb and Joshua. That was a lot of their legacy going on. So this passing of the torch, you could say, having Yehoshua stand up, and there in chapter 27, he will stand before Eleazar the priest, who shall inquire for him by the judgment of the Urim before the Lord. Now, the couple of the things mentioned in here about the Urim. So that's chapter 27 and verse 21. Now, the Urim and the Thummim are talked about starting in Exodus 28, verse 30, a description of what the high priest was going to wear with the breastplate. And it said, on this breastplate or in the breastplate, sometimes the Hebrew prepositions would be a little inexact, but in or on the breastplate, you had these things that were called the Urim and the Thummim. So Urim, here up here, and Thummim. Now Urim, the root part of that is Or. Let there be light. So Ur. So in this is plural, so this is lights. So on this, you're talking about lights. And the other one is Thummim, which comes from Tom. Tom means completeness. And actually, when they talk about the offerings, it's exactly the same spelling, just is now pronounced differently between Thummim and Tamim. Tamim is the daily offering, the morning and the afternoon sacrifices. Those are talked about in chapter 28 and 29. But here, we're talking about the Thummim. And the Thummim, both of them come from the same idea. It's the idea of completeness. It's not lacking anything. It is innocent. It is truthful. So this would be more like truthfulnesses or completenesses. So between lights and completenesses or totally complete. So those are the two things that it says are where the judgments come down. Now, it doesn't say specifically in the word how the judgments come down. There have been legends and various people have come up with ideas about how these things worked between yes and no, or did they light up in a certain order? Was this like some sort of a Morse code where they would come on in certain combinations and you would get sort of, does not say. It just says that whatever, by whatever method, they would come on and there would be some sort of a determination. Now, yeah, the Urim and the Thummim. Now, how decision was made with these two things, not described in Scripture at all. There have been, well, there's described as things being on the breastplate, and various people and commentators over the ages have come up with ideas from ideas like, you know, if you were asking a question. Some people had the idea that maybe the lights and the precious stones would light up for a given tribe or whatever. But, you know, for some of those that were opaque stones, it gets to be a little bit interesting. But somehow the high priest was to get a judgment that came from God based on this. Now, the importance was not how this happened. The importance was what message this thing is communicating, that the lights. Now, one of the things that this could maybe bring your attention to is the talk by the Apostle Yochanan or John about the Father of Lights. And that should also get your mind going about in Genesis chapter 1 about the one who put the lights up in the sky. So this is the Father of Lights, the creator of the lights you see up in the sky. So instead of like a lot of the nations that were involved in astrology or those sorts of things thought that the heavens were determining things on earth, this is the creator of all those who's doing something. Now, the other one in here is the Thummim, the completenesses, the what makes you complete, what makes you innocent or truthful. So the Father of Lights and the Father of Truthfulness. So between those two symbols there, you are getting a message from the Creator of all things and the one who is going to bring you truth in this. So thus, when you're coming down to the census between all these tribes, now notice that a reason that's given for this census here in Numbers 26 is described later on as the apportionment, that the big tribes get more land, the small tribes get less. Now also, with that, it's described as chosen by lot where they go. So you have, okay, you have a bigger tribe, you need more land to settle into. But then where you go in the land is also selected by lot. Now, we think of lot, okay, just get out the dice and yeehaw, and hope for some great jackpot. Yes, Yahtzee or whatever you're going to play. And it's just totally random way it's going to land. That's not what the Urim and the Thummim is all about. This is not like, you know, pull the handle and just hope for the best. This is, God is actually communicating something. When you talk about Lot, this is a purposeful action of deciding which way it's going to go. So, and this is done by a Levite. Why is that important? Because the Levites were out of the census totally. They were going to be scattered throughout the whole land. They didn't have a stake in this. You could say they were a neutral third party as much as they could be within Israel. Since they weren't going to get any particular land, they were, you could say, a neutral part of this. So God was going to determine where they were going to go and give them a place where there was enough land for them to be. Now, it's interesting when you go down through the later time periods where these tribes ended up in the land and where that ended up in history and the things that happened throughout history. It's like, wow, a lot of them get grouped together up in the north. The ones get grouped together down in the south. Wow, it almost looks like that was planned based on the character of the people involved and this and that and the other. So what looks like in the out on the surface as being a random thing is not random at all, and something that God is directing the path on this. Now, as we pass this out, we'll go into the last couple chapters, and the question there about all of these offerings. Now, just as we were talking at the outset of this, offerings, as you remember from Korban. When Korban means to bring, to draw near is what it means, to draw near. So these are surrogates. These are stand-ins for you to go into the presence of God. They're not gifts. They are stand-ins for you to come near. The offerings. Yeah, the offerings, because that's what the name means, is to things that are brought near. You're being coming into the presence of God, but you yourself cannot go there. You have to be transformed into something else that can come near. Something that is unblemished, is perfect, and that fits into these. You might notice a huge amount of repetition in these two chapters, but some of the things in people noted some differences that just in the number of the sacrifices, common things. It's very common among these on these various appointed times for two bulls, one ram, seven lambs, and one goat. So all of those are for burnt offerings. They all go up except for the goat, which is the sin offering, that which covers. Burnt offering, the olah, means just everything goes up. Now, some differences come in on some specific dates, such as the Yom Teruah and Yom Kippur. There is one bowl instead of two. And you'll also get that on Shemini Atzeret, or the eighth day, the day after the 7 days of Sukkot. There's only one instead of two. So you've got, that's interesting. They're all grouped together when? In the seventh month. So you think of those symbols. You've got lambs, that kind of harkens to Passover, innocence. You've got the picture of the bulls, the strength, the power, and the kind of association of the strength of the people. And then you've got the rams, the sense of the leadership of the people, and the goat, which are connected to Yom Kippur and the idea of covering. They're always associated with the sin offerings of covering. So in each one of these things, you've got connections of the bulls, the people, rams, the leadership of the people, the lambs, the innocent ones of the people, the innocence of the people, and then the goats of the guilt offering, to cover over the people. So all these things are covering one aspect or the other. The people altogether, the leadership, their return of their innocence, and covering over the sins of whatever that separated them from God was on all of these. So those ones where you saw a difference was on the seventh month, bringing things to completion. Now, something also that was also observed was during Sukkot, the 7 days of Sukkot, starts out in a different count with the number of bulls. You start out with a number that keeps going down, 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 down throughout all of them. And you're like, whoa, that's weird. Why is it starting out and then going down? It's like a countdown as you go through there. Bulls, again, people. What is it that Scripture talks about with Sukkot, especially like Zechariah, the prophecy of the Zechariah 14, the day of the Lord, the nations going up during the time of Sukkot, all the nations going up during the time of Sukkot. Sukkot pictured as a gathering in the people. And so kind of something similar to what Paul points out in Romans chapter 11 about the fullness of the nations. And when the fullness of the nations are brought in, then all Israel will be kind of brought in together to be complete. Because what does it end with on day 7? It counts down to 7 bulls. So the people have now reached completeness. It is now complete. They're all now in. So that is a picture of what all of these things are about. These are the things that bring you close. And the picture that we have is that the Messiah, Yeshua, is what brings us close. We are able to go into the presence of God because we go in through the veil, through the barrier between God's realm and just everybody's realm that He Himself put in there for our protection. We go in through the Messiah. The Messiah brings us in. We are brought near by the blood of the Lamb. So it's one of those great pictures that we have of these offerings, that it is something that is being brought to completion. God is bringing a whole people in. The people, the leadership, covering, restoring the innocence of the people. That's kind of what the goal is going out the other side. So you think about this. Yes, we have a comment down here.
When I was looking this up, the amount of meal, it had to go with the meat offering.
Yeah.
And it was like one...
Go with, or it's kind of a description of like go on, actually.
I didn't know what that meant, but it had to be with the meat offering. And it was like, for the bulls, it was like 28 quarts of meal with like a gallon and a probably mink oil mingle. So it really didn't give a description. But what does that mean? Because that's a lot of meat.
Yeah,
that's a lot of grain and oil.
Well,
and
you think of those things about the grain, oil, and wine. Grain, oil, and wine. Those are also some pictures that you have. Because we think of Shavuot or Pentecost, or the Feast of Weeks. That is another counting. You keep bringing in the harvest, up until you have now a full harvest at the end of the seven sevens, which is all about completion. So you've now reached completion of the things you're bringing in. The grain being another stand-in for people. A different type. Barley is associated with the Israel, and wheat being often associated with the nations. So between those two things of bringing in the barley, bringing in the wheat, is pictures of God collecting in all of the people in the world. And you got the wine there. Another picture that you see, kind of a stand-in for like the blood or the life of the people. Life being poured out. Life that's going out. But so this is a sense that, wow, there is life that had to be lost. And you talked about the animals, all these animals earlier. But the blood being pictured there in the wine, also a picture of life going out, that there was great cost involved. So the thinking man should be thinking, wow, the process of being brought near to God is extremely costly in life. Yeah, that's the message. Now, later on, you start getting through the prophets, and even Moshe hints at it in Deuteronomy 18, about this coming great prophet that was coming, that this great cost would be hugely costly to the kingdom of heaven as well, but also being hugely beneficial for all the nations because of it. So that being the great picture of the offerings is that there is a great bringing in of all the people in the world, and also that it was going to be a great cost involved, the cost of life. And you see later on, it's pictured there that this is talking about the Son of God. That life would have to be given up and then taken back. So that's one of the great pictures that we have in this. So you start out at the beginning part, it's like, wow, what a huge downfall has happened with Israel. They had this sneak attack that came in, got them in an area that besets all of us. It doesn't matter that time period, you know, Greek time period, Roman time period, modern time period, still all the same thing. The pull of that particular temptation is huge. Doesn't matter what time period you're in. And it's also a good picture of how, you could say, seductive the world away from God can really be, and to move away from that to the point that you don't really understand how far you've gone until you've gone a long way. It's one of those things I never understood when people that were older than me used to tell me before I reached my teen years. They said, decide what you're going to do when you get into a temptation of that sort well before you're going to do it, and rehearse it in your mind exactly how you're going to respond to this. Because when it happens, if you don't decide what you're going to do, you're just going to go with it. And wow, that's true. So that's one of those things that whether you're talking about something physical or an emotional or relational thing, if you don't stay really focused on where your relationship is, you won't even see it drift until it's gone. I know I've lost a number of friends that way because I never even realized that the relationship was just going to go in a way until it's like you meet up again and it's like, wow, we're so far apart. Really difficult to start that engine back up again because, you know, you've gone in completely different ways. So, yes, Kat, Evan.
Offerings, because where did they get all this stuff?
Well, a number of the things that they talked about with the herds that talked about that they went out with all these herds from Egypt, and over time, this is 40 years, they had a lot of time to propagate the herds, not only for the food but also for the things that would be done later. And then you also had an entire tribe, their whole tribe, the tribe of Levi, their whole job was to basically raise animals. for this. So you see later on in the time period of like in the Gospels and Gospel Luke talks about these shepherds out at night, you know. Doesn't say specifically, but most likely they were probably Levites if they were had anything to do with stuff coming for the coming whatever festival it was, whether it was, you know, Hanukkah, Passover, time period. That's a huge function that the Levites were doing, was raising the stock. Because especially when you get to the first century, these people coming in from all parts of the Roman Empire, as far away in the east as Parthia, which is like modern day, you know, but Iran, going into Afghanistan. Those people weren't bringing flocks with them. Because actually the Torah says, yeah, you sell them where you're at, take the money, you come to where God's name is, then you buy what you need, and then you bring that offering in. Well, that means that when you get there, there has to be something to buy. So that's why the Levites, their role was to raise the animals that could be used for sacrifices. So that comes into the point of, okay, that's a necessary thing that you do, but how do you do it? Do you turn it into a money-making operation, which is what when he talks about, when we talk about zealous, you know, and Yeshua goes into the temple and chases out the money changers and the idea of changing foreign money into temple shekels and whether there would be an exchange rate involved that was making a bit of a profit there and how much of a profit and that sort of thing got to be quite onerous as you read Josephus' writings at the time period. But what is it that you are actually doing? Are you in the service for God or in the service for yourself, claiming to be in the service of God? To the point where Yeshua came in there and says, you know, this is supposed to be a house of prayer for all nations. Got the clue that, hey, these are people who are supposed to be coming in, kind of hearkening back to Solomon's prayer, coming in from all over the world. Yet you've made it a den of robbers. And quoting from another part of the prophets, talking about how the faithful service of Israel had been turned into a, you could say, a life-sucking business. So again, that fine line that can go from serving God to serving yourself and actually being a detriment to the whole service of God. A fine line to go in that's determined by where your heart is. So I hope through all of this that you've seen that a hugely bad situation is something that God says, I'm going to bring you back. Here is a huge life preserver that's coming your way. Just grab onto it and then come back into the presence of God. Yes?
Is there a difference in the word work, though? That was one of my questions.
Oh, the word work, yes.
Because in two different, in chapter 29 and 26 just said the word work, whereas
yes,
all the other descriptions said no servile work. So I was wondering, because I don't have a Hebrew or Greek thing to look things up, so I didn't know what if there was a difference in the, if God meant something different between the word work for the for our holidays.
Yeah, you know, an example of that, like in chapter 29, verse 7, about not doing any work, that is what? It's on Yom HaKippurim, or the Day of Atonement. That is a part where you're supposed to, like, completely stop. The other ones are ones where, okay, things can continue, but one of the points that, as we go through the study of the Day of Atonement, you're focusing on what one person is doing. One person in all of Israel, what they are doing. That one person is going directly into the presence of God. The high priest is going directly into the presence of God. So that was so important that God just saying, look, even just your basic stuff, just don't do it. You've got to really dedicate, even to the point of, you know, denying your appetites and such on that day to really focus on what's really happening. Because, okay, yeah, you get thirsty, yeah, you get hungry, but what what is actually happening? Do we actually realize that we are thirsty and actually hungry for the presence of God? Is that something that we actually have on a regular basis or not? And one day a year to actually reflect upon what it is that we've lost and what it is that we gain. So one of those reasons why God gives the instruction, hey, stop everything. And which is terrible in our go, go, go culture to say stop everything. But one of those things that people are realizing more and more the importance of stopping. Sadly, it's kind of gone the whole other route to the point of stopping everything, including thinking and trying to empty your mind of any thoughts of whatever. But instead, God tells us, hey, instead focus on what it is that I'm doing. So let's close out with prayer. Father, we thank you for giving us the words of your servants and for giving us your Spirit to help us understand what it is that you're doing. Father, we thank you for having mercy on us to take us from our foolishness to get dragged away by things, being so short-sighted we don't actually see what's going on. Father, we thank you for having mercy on us. We thank you for showing us through your Son who came here and has lived through the same trials that we have and realize how difficult they are. Father, we thank you that you've designed this to be our high priest, to take us into your presence. And we thank you in the name of your Son, Yeshua. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info. Hallel.info.